This podcast is brought to you by the InterAstra Institute, the global public square for the business of space. Join us at interastra.space.
I'm Lisa Maricino. I'm the CEO of Proteus Ocean Group, a Fabian Cousteau-led company. We're building Proteus, which is the International Space Station of the Ocean, a habitat and a living workspace so we can study the ocean.
And I'm Kathy Sullivan, formerly of NASA as an astronaut and NOAA as the head of the American Ocean Agency. And I've heard of Proteus and seen some press about it. And of course, I know of Fabian as much as probably he knows about me. Our paths have crossed episodically, but we've never found something to make useful mischief about together.
I am the only person to have walked in space and gone to the deepest point in the ocean. Hi, I'm Kathy Sullivan. And I'm an explorer. Exploring doesn't always have to involve going to some remote or exotic place. It simply requires your commitment to put curiosity into action. So join me on this podcast journey as I reflect on lessons learned from life so far and from my brilliant and ever-inquisitive guests. We'll explore together in this very moment from right where you are. Spaceship not required. Welcome to Kathy Sullivan Explores.
Today's conversation with CEO of Proteus Ocean Group, Lisa Maricino, was recorded in person back in November of 2023 at the InterAstra retreat. The InterAstra Institute is a nonprofit established by the Bolden Group, and along with various podcasts, including this one, it hosts and attends a number of events throughout the year. The retreat itself is a small gathering of leaders, workforce, and students from different industries around the world, who come together once a year to discuss the business of space through the lens of creating equitable access and opportunity. Now, retreat sessions take place under Chatham House rules, meaning they are strictly not for attribution. But casual hallway conversations are fair game, especially if you've asked explicitly for permission to record. I managed to capture a few such conversations in the corridors along with my producer, Toby Goodman, and I'll be sharing these with you over the coming weeks. Because after all, InterAstra's intent is to open the doors of opportunity to everyone, surely including you, my explorers. Now, another thing that makes the InterAstra retreat unique is that it's not just another gathering of all the usual space industry insiders, as the conversation you're about to listen to will make clear. And just as with any fantastic conversation among friends, Lisa and I carried on for a few more minutes after we sort of had agreed to end the conversation. Fortunately, our recorder was still running. So you'll hear a short transition at what was meant to be the end of our main chat before that last in-the-moment piece, that wrap-up bit, which I hope you'll also find valuable. So now, on with the show.
Where did the birth of Proteus happen? Maybe a colleague that you know well, Dr. Sylvia Earle.
Oh, just a little bit.
Just a little bit. I figured that. And she's iconic and epic and just as you are. And she went down to Aquarius, which is the last habitat, in 2012.
Yep. And I've been to Aquarius, I think it was a bit before that. But
exactly. Yeah. And so she was concerned that they were going to take it away and take it out and that we would lose that wonderful tool in the ocean. So Fabian went to visit her, and that's where this kind of idea was born of maybe doing a longer expedition. Now, he wanted to do 31 days, which is meaningful because it was one more day than his grandfather spent in conch shell.
Yep.
And he was very intent on that. And they fought him a little bit on that front. They said, no, 17 days. And he was like, nope, 31. They also fought him on the front of having two women down. He plucked these wonderful women, Liz McGee from Northeastern and Grace Young from MIT, and they fought him on those two aspects too, and he said no. So he went down in 2014.
Two women was too few or too many?
They were not experienced, that they were concerned about the close proximity of how everyone was going to be down there.
We don't know where to go to the bathroom.
All these things. And they said, just make it easy. Yeah. Do all men. And he was like, no. And they still, to this day, Grace and Liz.
Since when is all men easy?
Exactly. Exactly. So to this day, they really still are excited and want to experience the second Proteus or the second round of the missions.
So a little preamble to your backstory, just for point of interest.
When I was quite young, 9, 10, 11-ish kind of time frame, Fabian's grandfather, Jacques, was a figure on television. And I remember vividly for a year or so of my life, we would get, my mother was an avid reader, so we would get two weekly magazines that were sort of feature story magazines. One was called Life, one was called Look, and of course National Geographic would come every month. And for, I think, about a year of my life, every issue of each one of those magazines had at least one story about the exploits of the new thing called astronauts, and kind of right next door, commonly in the same issue, and a story about the emerging exploits of aquanauts. And I remember very much reading about conch shell and the notion of we're going to have people living and working in space, and we're going to have stations underwater where people live and work. So those two, they did not, those two motivators, those two inspiring adventurous stories did not right away plant in my head, I want to be an astronaut or an aquanaut. But I was very much drawn to, these are curious people. They're asking themselves big questions. They're thinking of very new things, and they're learning how to learn how to do those things. And it's very adventurous. So that adventurous and inquisitive combination, that was very attractive to me. And I knew I somehow want my life to be like that.
That's so, it's exciting.
It's sort of a circle and a half kind of.
Well, and it's so, that's so super interesting. And I always think a lot about what happened back then, right? Because the ocean and space really were almost equal. And if they had
side by side, they were side by side. Yep.
I think that a lot of the planetary issues that we have today and problems that would be less. I would hope that would be the case. We have a very large obligation and opportunity to get back there. And, you know, we must go to space. Should have been like, we must go to space and ocean. That didn't happen. But I think we, to Jacques' credit, we're having the same conversations we had back then. And I think that's what's exciting about working with Fabian. He wants to pick up that torch and say, I'm going to take that from my grandfather, everything I've learned from these past pioneers, and build this. So when he came up from Mission 31, he was asked, what do you want to do next? And he said, I want to do this bigger, better. We got to put more scientists down there. And so he embarked on this long journey. I wish I had met him in 2015, because I think we would already have one in the ocean. But it took a while for him, for us to find each other. But when I asked him, one thing that really drew me to the project, so many things, his passion and the whole idea. But I said, Fabian, how am I going to sell this to investors? Because we need capital to build these, right? And we want to do it in a way that we don't just build one, like with the past. We want to change what we've done in the past. We want to build multiples of these, create a business and industry so that we can keep it sustainable and keep it moving. And I said, how am I going to sell this to investors? How am I going to sell this to the public? And he said, well, these are the things that happened on Aquarius. And I said, well, okay, tell me. And he said, we talked to 100,000 students underwater. I was like, wow, that's a big number for back in 2014. We got 34 billion impressions, so people cared about what was happening. And we tested technologies that could be a revenue stream for the future. But the most important piece that he said to me is, we did 3 years worth of equivalent research in those 31 days. I go, what? How did you do that? He said, because we were saturated. We got to dive 10 to 12 hours a day. We were only limited by our human capacities. Yep. And I found that just super exciting. And I said, I can sell that. We can accelerate time. We can't get it back, but we might be able to catch up.
Fascinating. Yeah. The other thought that occurs to me, motivated partly by the different conversations we've been having here at InterAstra, NASA nowadays, the finale of Sylvia's story of hoping to preserve Aquarius, I had a little bit of an oblique hand in that, because many years before that, in the early 90s, was trying to urge NASA to recognize the value of that as a training vehicle for astronauts who were going to go start to spend, not just the kind of week-long timeframes we did in shuttle, but longer, it's going to become longer durations. And that some lessons of you are here, you are stuck here, this is the place, everything about maintaining it, owning it, cleaning it, knowing how to operate, and what does it let you do in that environment. It's a microcosm, it's not as demanding, but that also means it's more accessible, it can be cycled through more people more rapidly. It took a long time before NASA finally got to that. And of course, they do now use NEMO as they call it, one of the training modes to get astronauts ready for long duration stays on the space station. And it's also partly the human factors of honing your ability to work together very efficiently, very effectively as a team.
Yes.
Because once you go underwater, I don't care where you came from, what your name is, who your daddy is, what your bank account is. It's just us. And so we've got to arrive at that working mode together that's built on enough trust and confidence to be effective when the bad stuff happens. So I think a lot of the discussion here at InterAstra has been about, you know, how do we expand the aperture? How do we open the aperture so more people, younger people, people of more diverse backgrounds can start to be part of, can get into the game and get some experiences that help them find their way into a space career or a space adjacent career? It's not going to happen by suddenly magically having more and more astronaut seats readily available. Mm-hmm. But it could happen. It's a different economic challenge. It's a lower economic hurdle. It's a lower logistics hurdle to give some of these young students or would-be entrepreneurs a chance to try some of the living and working in an exotic and challenging environment. And it might look a bit like a detour from your space path, and it is a bit of a detour from your space path, but it will give you some insights and some lessons about how to navigate your space path. It will be very worthwhile. Yeah. So, you know, that aspect of it's a capture function, it's a booster step that will be easier to get to for a larger number of people that can become feedstock, both to ocean careers, to ocean sciences, or to space. Yeah. And, you know, it's not for us to pick which direction or which endpoint.
More science.
Yeah, more intelligent people.
Exactly.
Equipped with the skills to help tackle complex problems. The planet needs those. Yeah.
I love that. I love that way of thinking. I agree. I mean, we'd love to see every young person kind of come through Proteus and then decide, you know, do I want to be an astronaut? Do I want to be an aquanaut? Do I want to be a scientist? I think we will have that opportunity. I think it is much more economical, right? So we will have that opportunity to have a place for them to go in that we call it the suborbital, maybe under 47 minutes, where you can come down, get a little glimpse of what it is, and then go back up to the surface. Maybe we have an Obama and Anderson Cooper interview. That would be fun to have them come down. But the idea is to give that accessibility to students, artists, and all that. And what I love about Che and Che's mission and the Bolden mission here with Charlie and what they've been able to create is that accessibility. When we first started talking, I don't know, maybe a year and a half to 2 years ago, we talked about this idea. How do you give young people more access? How do you give, how do you create more equality? And I think it's difficult because there aren't people that have access, but we have an opportunity to create more of that access. Even the idea that I'm here, I'm an ocean person here at a space conference, and then we've had to stop thinking about it, you know, space, it's really inner space, outer space, it's space. And we need to think of it as one big ecosystem.
An even different way of thinking about it occurs to me as you say that, not to compete with it or correct it, but just another angle, is it's just two different venues for inspiring and preparing people to help solve problems on Earth. And I think, you know, maybe borrowing my own personal example a little too much here, but let's give them those experiences and let's not even worry about whether, and at the end of these 3 days, they decide they're going to be an astronaut, they're going to be an aquanaut. That's lovely if they get that far. But, you know, kids at different ages are at all sorts of different frames of mind about life or career or who they are, how well they know yet who they are. I was clueless at their age. But if the experience, where you get to go, the wonder of the place you're in, the intrigue and interests and model of the people you're with, if that sparks in a young person, if that serves as the same kind of magnet for a young person that the exemplars of Cousteau and the early astronauts were for me, they didn't look like me.
Yeah.
They were the wrong gender. They were a different age. But what they were doing was so magnetic at a human level. And our family was not highly binned, like girls do this and boys do that. Right. So my parents, if you're interested in something, we're interested in supporting you. And it doesn't matter whether you wear a dress or slacks. That doesn't matter. You pursue it. So I was a little inoculated against these stereotypes of this is not something you should be interested in. But if you can light that bit of a spark of fire in a young person, there's no getting around the need for each individual to have some drive. We all have to propel ourselves forward to a great degree. It's wonderful to have help and mentors and guideposts. Take all of that you can find. But at the end of the day, it's on us as an individual to prepare, to show up, and to persevere. Absolutely. So why am I excited and compelled to prepare and show up and persevere? Because I want my life to be, you know, something is drawing me in. Right. So
We're missing that. Not to forget that
aspect.
I love it. The power of the moments.
Yeah.
We want to bring those back. Both, I think, in space and ocean is so important. You're so right. I have a question for you because you're one of the few people in the world, probably. I mean, you can count them that have done both.
I'm actually the first person to do both.
You're the first person to do both and one of a very, very small club. I know Ron Guerin has a quote in one of our decks that talks about his experience, but I want to hear from you. What was it like to look back at Earth, but then also to be underwater and have that experience? Can you describe it a little bit?
Well, so, you know, true confessions, my real big reason for even applying to be an astronaut was because of the possibility of seeing the Earth from orbit with my own eyes. I had studied as an Earth scientist. My interest was always this planet, map, every aspect of geography that exists. Maps, where people live, how they live, cultures, economies, landscape, all of that was always what fascinated me most. And so I ended up in college and grad school studying Earth sciences and then shifting into geology of the deep seafloor, in part because those kinds of expeditions gave me that similar kind of adventure and inquisitiveness to the astronaut and aquanaut missions. I could get my hands around that and do it. And it might have been where I ended up, or it was a stepping stone. I didn't know at the time. So that's what inspired me even to go into space. And so maybe that puts a little extra sizzle or value to me of getting to actually do it because it had been on my mind for so long. I think I guarantee you, I had looked at every single photograph any astronaut had ever taken of the Earth before I flew.
Amazing.
And then I got to see it myself. And it certainly enriched the experience for me. Everyone is blown away by that first glimpse, but for me, it was like climbing up to the Olympic gold medal platform, something I had aimed for so long. I mean, you just can't beat, I think, the inspirational value of having that perspective on this planet that we live on. You see whole continents at a glance. You're lapping around the planet in 90 minutes. Just so many things that take all your frame of reference for living on Earth and blow them up and, you know, just shape them and shift them completely. Nice. It's very powerful. Uh-huh. You know, Frank White calls it the overview effect. I'm fond of calling it the small self effect, that you suddenly realize how small you are and how big. The big reality is we're just all on this little planet. That's the big reality. I'm not the big reality. So you can't beat that.
So powerful. Giving me chills.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
It's hugely powerful.
Yeah.
Conversely, going deep in the ocean, I mean, beyond a couple hundred feet, there's not much light. You can't see.
Right.
You know, we are visual creatures. You know, your most powerful input sensor, your eyes, kind of stop being useful below about 1,000 feet or so in the ocean. So, and that's powerful. That means it takes us, we are easily inspired by beautiful views. That's a natural avenue for inspiration. And you lose that going deep in the ocean. And the other thing, not to discount too much, is that in, you know, popular literature and human literature going back as far as you can find, the ocean figures as a mysterious and ominous foreboding place. Mm-hmm. You know, the cold, gray, fish-bearing sea of Homer and the ship sailed and they never came back and there's Larrabee monsters, all that kind of stuff. So many people come to the ocean with it more of a leaning away instead of leaning in.
Mm-hmm.
But what's magical and vitally important about the ocean is the ocean is the life of this planet.
Yeah.
It is the largest living volume on the planet. The greatest amount of biomass on the planet lives in the ocean. All the stuff on the dirt are smaller fractions. And it is the life support system for everything else that lives on the ocean. So it's vital that we invest more in understanding the ocean for the sake of understanding how our life support system works. But that's so much more an intellectual pursuit than just the aspirational pursuit. So we've got to find ways to get over that hurdle.
We have to bring back the storytelling. And I think that's the opportunity with putting Gusteau back in the ocean and being able to connect the storytelling, the magic inspiration. We're at 60 feet, so there is some great light. And I do agree, we have to study the deeper ocean. But the good news about Proteus is we will be at that.
But let's start with magic and wonder, right?
Yes.
I mean, what was the draw of my octopus teacher?
Yes.
It's a very human story.
Yeah.
And it's just the wonder of this interaction between two intelligent creatures.
Exactly.
And that revelation that the the slimy one with eight tentacles is about as intelligent, at least, as the guy with flippers on, right?
He taught him some things, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Who's teaching who?
Well, and
right?
It's great that you bring that up. We're actually working with Off the Fence, who won the award. Mm-hmm. We've been working with them for about a year and change. They're working on a sizzle reel and pitching the Proteus story. And so we have a lot of confidence that they're going to come up with something just as wonderful about Proteus and connecting humans and changing the way humans interact with the ocean.
So that would be my avenue of entry and key selling point for the general public wanting to come to Proteus. It's experience the magic and wonder of the sea for yourself.
Exactly.
You know, come meet the magical creatures.
Yes.
You know, make an octopus your friend.
Exactly.
Right? That's get it back to a very human visceral experience.
Exactly. Yes.
And just, you know, dazzle them. Let them feel just enjoy, enraptured by the experience.
Fall in love with it.
You know,
absolutely.
If you make people fall in love with the ocean again.
Yeah.
30 seconds or a day or two, they will follow you. They will continue the journey.
Exactly.
But so the first thing is give them something they can fall in love with.
Yeah. The stories that came out of Mission 31, and there are so many that I probably haven't heard, but some of the few that I have heard is they were down there for the first day and there was this little fish that came to the window. And then the second day, they thought it was the same fish. And then the third day. And for 31 days, they were like, that's impossible. And then they started doing the, you know, the tracking and the striping. And like, and it was the same fish that came to the to portal window for 31 days, watching the humans inside. And
you guys invaded my neighborhood.
Like, check us out. Doing here? Yeah. And then the two big groupers.
I'm the neighborhood watch.
Exactly. The two big groupers that they ended up naming Jacques and Sylvia that lived under Aquarius that would have these big cavitational barks and, you know, like, oh, there's Jack and Sylvia again. But those are the kind of stories I think that we can share with the world and so many more. The discoveries, you know, the failings and the successes that I think are so important to show people out there what is happening in our ocean. How can, not just the doom and gloom, but how can we save it? How can we find that little coral that's surviving all this bad stuff? And what? Why is it surviving? And how can we take that learning and bring it to the rest of the coral system?
So one of the reasons I think it's important to show the learning how to do it as well is, again, many different motivations will bring people to this. But the planetary issues, the societal issues that plenty of us are worried about, those are big, hard things to do. And, you know, how do big things get done? Well, this is an environment where you can learn some lessons about how to get big things done. You're going to be learning, they're smaller building block lessons, but they're the same basics at a bigger scale. Right. So it's also that kind of a training ground for how does something big get done? And so that, whether that's a video or a TV show, it's bringing people along as viewers of your experience, but then showing that experience and showing how did we get around this hurdle? And be honest about, you know, I was really pissed off at Lisa about this. We, you know, we went tooth and nail at this argument and here's how we solve that.
Yeah.
So it's not just, we both shouted at each other and then decided to never talk to each other again. We've got to find ways to get past those shouting moments, those disagreement moments, back to, we still disagree on these things, but can't we just try this?
Solve the problem,
Or at least can we just find a step we can both agree to take and keep learning together to find our way forward?
That has been the biggest lesson in this whole thing is really, it's about pivoting and changing, being fluid to adapt, because there have been lots of things that have come out that have not been in our control. We started before COVID, and that was devastating. We didn't know if we could go forward. We persevered. And I would say that's my one big advice to any young person trying to do anything, is you've got to stay strong to what you believe in and figure out ways around. If you can't go over it, go under it, go on the side of it, but you can get to that solution if you think out of the box and you stay strong and you persevere. And I joined in late 2019, and it's been a story of perseverance and surrounding myself with really great people who believe in the same mission. Don't surround yourself with the people who are negative. Surround yourself with the people who are positive and who are going to help you lift in those times of adversity or that something is not going well. So those are great wise words, and I've taken them to heart.
Sometimes pays, though, to at least listen to what the naysayers are saying. There might be a nugget of wisdom. There might be a nugget of real wisdom you should be humble enough to take aboard and rethink. There might also be a hint or a clue about, I can deflect or I can overcome, I can counter their negative argument. I didn't see it through that angle.
Right. So absolutely. Yeah, I mean, every conversation's worth having. You're right.
Yeah.
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
At least listen.
Yes. Exactly. So here we are in 2024. Our plan is to get in the water by 2026, 2027 in Curaçao. And we hope to have a lot of astronauts. We're planning on a simulation of a lunar landing so that we can have astronauts come and train exactly what they were doing on Aquarius, and in more astronauts, hopefully we can accommodate more and more astronauts.
So is the European Space Agency also engaged? Has NASA been responsive so far?
I mentioned we have a CRADA with both NOAA and Navy. We are in discussions with a lot of the people, in particularly the HRP program, who are very interested in kind of how do we train.
HRP is?
A human resource program within NASA.
Okay.
And they're the ones that kind of are doing the training. They've asked us many questions about how many people can we train at once or what kinds of facilities. So that input from all those agencies is going to be very important as we're entering this next stage of design and engineering, because we want to design those simulated modules for those agencies so that we can accommodate what they want out of the facility like this.
So another challenge, I wonder if you've thought about there are logistical and other factors that certainly would be interesting challenges to overcome. But one of the big challenges and concerns about the ocean is getting governmental and big economy decision makers to recognize the importance of and understand, take a deeper understanding of the ocean. You know, one way to do that, you know, the Sierra Club will take policymakers out into the field and, you know, away from their comfort zone and have them really experience the wilderness. Sven Lindblad, some years ago, took a bunch of people from, you know, former President Carter to some scientists and others, put them on a ship, and they sailed together to the Arctic. So kind of like in Durastro, you're now having an experience together.
Right.
All the protocol is kind of stripped away. You're being dazzled by something together, you get a different kind of conversation. You accelerate some relationship building that can pay some dividends later, because it's not now just the foreign minister from so-and-so. It's Lisa, and I know her, and we communicated well together. So you open up, you widen communication channels.
Yes.
60 feet of water, going under 60 feet of water is a little more of a hurdle for someone who's maybe in their 50s or 60s or 70s, maybe isn't a scuba diver.
Right.
You thought about whether there are ways to bring some people like that down to Proteus?
Yes. In fact, one of the things that we are really looking at, if they don't want to scuba dive, is having a submersible, that they would get into the submersible.
And then lock them out.
And come in and then be able to come up into the moon pool, which is that water-air interface, open the hatch, and then they would have about 47 minutes on the outside, but really we'd leave them there for 30 minutes. They could do a tour. They could get a sense of what that living underwater is like, look out the portals, and then we would send them back up. And I think that ability...
And it would be 47-minute limit because?
Because of the decompression issues. So we would want to make sure.
The submersible, if you wanted to go longer than 47 minutes,
yes,
the craft that took them back to the surface would have to be able to sustain a pressure. It would have to basically be a diving chamber.
Exactly.
And help them adjust their bodies back.
And anything's possible. So those are things that we would consider if that would be something that's important. But I think in the beginning, just giving access to potential students, like we could do all kinds of challenges that some students would win, or teachers, artists, you know, having, I don't know who, come down and sing a song and having the world kind of see that, I think are all things that we will entertain, because I think that's really important to open that lens up to a broader view. How many people have, you know, besides scuba diving or being on a boat on top of the ocean, how many people have experienced what it is to be almost in an aquarium under the ocean looking out? So I think that important lens is something that we want to share with the world.
You talk with the Atlantis submersible operators. Is that... they still operate in Curaçao?
We are in partnership with U-Boat Works, which is a Danish and Netherlands company, and they are working with us on this. But obviously, we're somewhat agnostic on that.
Yeah.
We want to work with others.
The Atlantis submersibles are a couple of dozen people, if I remember right, lovely little white submarines that usually meet you at some raft and you go down to 60 or maybe 100 feet on some lovely reef, and it's a 30 to 45 minute, maybe hour long experience. But you know, to drive by a station to see people living underwater at 60 feet, just making that vivid and real to someone who's driving by.
Exactly.
Could still be an interesting.
We will have that offering for sure. And with U-Boat Works, we're working on that idea that we could have rides, you know, within approximately a safe Proteus, but having that that accessibility to show people what it is. There are people living and working in that facility over there. And there will be, obviously, the ecosystem includes robotics and other pieces, so they would actually get to see what does the lunar landing look like. They might even see astronauts out there working on robotics. And so that is really just brings it to light.
Yeah.
And I think also makes the connection of the ocean space. Wait a minute, there are astronauts training on the seabed here. I think a lot of people don't know that you have to be, you know, you train.
They in don't an, appreciate in an, the parallels and the right. commonalities.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So I think that having Scott Parazynski has just joined our team, helping us with some of that. And he's, you know, it's really wonderful to see what he's been able to share and all the use cases. And he really believes in this as a big tool for space to create more cohesion, to train more astronauts, to potentially even train some of the less professional, right? Because you have a lot more private citizens now wanting to become
astronauts. That's actually the cohort I was thinking of.
Yeah,
They've never been in any kind of operational environment where you had those realities from the human interaction to the technical to the I didn't really study my repair manual very well. Well, that's too bad because that's your toilet just broke. Maytag repairman does not live nearby, so you better break out that manual and figure it out.
I should mention the rest of the team just slightly. Like, we have just an incredible A-plus team. My business development person, Lisa Truitt, from Nat Geo, 25 years. So she knows how to tell stories. Mm-hmm. And she built an immersive experience in Times Square. And that's who's working on both creative and biz dev. And then we've got director marketing from AOL. Our director of partnerships is Formula One. Our senior VP of engineering is a Raytheon person. So we really, our two lead scientists are Northeastern. The talent that we've been able to attract to this project is just really class A. And I really appreciate and grateful for them, because we've been able to advance to where we are because of the teamwork and the vision. And then, of course, with Fabian being the visionary at the top. So it's really
very cool.
Incredible team. Yeah.
I will track it up closely.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to share your thoughts and to hear your perspective and your vision. It's really beautiful, and I appreciate that.
My pleasure. So another piece of the space ocean connection that I think about a lot is our understanding of the ocean accelerated at warp speed thanks to the space age. Mm-hmm. Because it was not until we had, you know, satellites, remote sensing satellites in orbit that could help us image the Earth, get data from all around the Earth in essentially a snapshot. So for the first time in human history, we could kind of have a snapshot of the conditions on the surface of the ocean thanks to satellites. Mm-hmm. And it was that snapshot in 1973 that helped us realize scientifically, what is an El Nino? Why do the herring fisheries off Ecuador crash every now and then? Because that was known. They crash, and then sometimes they don't, and they crash. And so it happens, and it's not super regular. It's like every 4 to 7 years. And I think it's just the Ecuadorian herring fishery. Until we got satellites who realized, no, the reason that's happening is a slosh across the entire Pacific. So it's like scales fell from our eyes and we could understand the dynamics of a full ocean basin. So better understanding of our ocean, practical understanding of our ocean, tracking and monitoring of our activities in the ocean, nowadays all depend critically on space assets. Space has helped us understand the ocean. Understanding our ocean is about understanding how we sustain life on this planet, because the ocean is the life support system of this planet. Every other breath you take is oxygen generated by marine organisms. That's how much you personally depend on the ocean, no matter where you live.
As Kathy articulated so beautifully, really it is where life began, the ocean. There are so many things we don't know about it. We've only explored, you know, less than 10%, probably less than that. And so we do need to get back into that space and study it 24/7. And I know that this is an analogy that we use a lot, like the Jane Goodall, Diane Fossey. If they had been dropped down from an air balloon for 30 minutes at a time, taking some snapshots and then gone back up, they would have never given us the kind of knowledge and that we have today, that we've learned about our primates and their ecological, biological environment. It's the same with the ocean. We have not done long-term time series in situ permanent studies. And so that kind of knowledge that we are missing, that Proteus will allow, the platform will allow that continuous study, and not just in one location, but if you think 5 years from now or 10 years, I think you asked me the 10-year, someone asked me, what is the 10-year model? And I said, we hope to have at least 6 habitats in different parts of the ocean, interconnected. So they're all speaking to each other, using whether it's a Starlink or satellite systems to communicate. So now you've got information, data being transferred from space, as you said, is so important. What kind of deeper knowledge can we now learn being in the ocean? And there you go. Now you've made that full connection, why it's so important. From medicine to food to energy, the answers are there. We just haven't discovered them yet.
My other thought for the young professionals would be, and I think I would make this argument, I would offer this argument to someone, regardless of whether their goal was become an astronaut or go to space or just run a business in space. There's some challenging experiences that you can have on Earth that are among the best skill-building experiences you can get while not in space, that will help you, equip you, prepare you better to either know what the realities, appreciate the realities of operating a business in space or flying in space or whatever. And it's, you know, it's remote research stations on Earth, like the Antarctic. It's an underwater experience like, you know, Nemo and Aquarius or Proteus. And, you know, I spoke recently to Christina Cook, who's the woman who's on the Artemis II mission, slated to be the first woman to fly to the moon, probably 2025. Her pathway to becoming an astronaut was not motivated just by, I want to collect all the beads on my string that will make me an astronaut. It was motivated by a deeper drive of what experiences can make me a better, stronger, more versatile person in the world of sciences, because that was her thing. She did the Antarctic. She did American Samoa Field Station. She did those things sort of recognizing that these are analogs, useful analogs from a skills point of view to the kinds of things and skills I will need if I ever do get to go be an astronaut. But they're worthy in their own right, and they're valuable to me in their own right. It was forging a career path that met her aptitudes for adventure, for inquiry, for science, and for purpose. So all of the right reasons. But the punchline point is, I want to be an astronaut, so I only want space internships, I only want this, I only want that. You've made a checklist of what you think will get you there, and you're probably right with a lot of them. But don't ignore, don't overlook the value of a real-world, mission-style, challenging experience in the Antarctic or in a Proteus. That's different. Get you out of a building, away from the coffee pot, change your working environment completely, and still look you in the eye and say, figure out how to put all that aside, get this done. That's a kind of challenge that will hone and forge all the aptitudes, all the resilience that you need. So take whatever building blocks you can.
Thanks so much for joining me on today's mission. For more solo shows and deep dives with incredible guests, along with all the ways to get the podcast and much more, head over to KathySullivanExplores.com.
This podcast is brought to you by the InterAstra Institute. New episodes are available on Spotify, Apple Music, and most everywhere podcasts are found. To be the first to know when the next episode drops, head over to interastra.space.